The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
What I considered a difficult assignment in one class to tell you everything about nanotubes, and I was going about as fast as the wind. I was going really, really too fast for comprehension. But hopefully you got sort of an idea about what is developing in this very, very tiny one-dimensional system. Today I'm going to talk about a different topic. And this topic is one that I work rather closely with Professor Chen and have been for almost the past 10 years. Long before he came to MIT. So, anyway, what this is about is that nanostructures have opened up the field of thermoelectricity, which was a field that wasn't moving very rapidly for many years, 30 years before nano came along. But nano came along to this field a long time before it was called nano. So, anyway, I'm going to tell you about it and why it's relevant. And in so doing, you will hear about a whole bunch of different phenomena that happen for small dimensional systems, some of which you've already heard in other connections in this course. I don't know precisely all the things that Professor Chen has covered with you, but there'll be some small amount of review between what you've heard, and a small review is always good for education because it connects things that you have in your mind. So I'm going to today give you some overview about the low-dimensional systems and tell you about thermoelectricity. I know that in this course you have a lot of material about thermal transport, because that's really what mechanical engineers are doing. They're doing nano heat transfer, and this is what this is couples to very strongly. That's one of the important newly emerging fields in mechanical engineering. And then I'll mention about some specific systems that we have worked on where the improved performance is demonstrated. And then I'll end up with some future directions, what people are doing right now. So in this summary view graph, by the way, just as last time, I'm going to make this whole lecture available to you on the web, the class website. And so I guess right after the lecture, it should appear there. So then you can go. So there are two basic effects, thermoelectric effects. And the first one is the Seebeck effect. And with that, we have a temperature difference. So like, for example, your thermocouple is an example of this. You know that that's one way that we measure temperature. It's a temperature measuring tool, and it works on the Seebeck effect. And what it's about is that if you have a temperature difference, so one of these ports will be a reference temperature. Suppose we put it in ice or something like that, so we know exactly the temperature. And the other one is the variable temperature that you want to know. So you measure the temperature difference, and because of the Seebeck effect, there's a voltage that will develop between these two terminals, one at the higher temperature, a different temperature than the temperature of your standard. And by measuring the voltage and knowing the Seebeck coefficient, this coefficient that relates the voltage that you measure to the temperature difference, you can find out what the temperature is. So that's the way your thermocouple works. And every different thermocouple will have a different coefficient, S, Seebeck coefficient, and that's known and it's published in tables for specific thermocouples. So if you want to measure something for your thermocouple, you look up the Seebeck coefficient in a table, and then you can find out all the information. So you get the calibration. So that's the way that works. And with the Peltier effect, well, the Seebeck effect would be used also for practical applications for heating or cooling. So by if you want to do some refrigeration or something like that, you would you have. There are two effects. One is cooling, and I'll go into that in a moment. And the other one is conversion of power between electrical form and heat form. So you could, if you want to go and have a spacecraft, and you provide heat by some kind of source that you put on the spacecraft, you can get electricity from that to run all the instruments on your space Voyager. So that's the some idea of that. But the physics behind this, the idea of why all of this thing works, is that the if you have a semiconductor. So the carrier density that you have will be temperature dependent. So the higher the temperature, the more carriers that are generated. So you get a difference in the density of your carriers from the hot and the cold junction because of that. And because you have a difference in the carrier density, you're going to have a voltage associated with different amount of charge. So you get a temperature gradient produces a voltage. And the Peltier effect is similarly related, that heat in and heat out is equivalent to having a voltage which is supplied by the external source as the current goes around. And so the the two application areas are shown here, one for refrigeration, where you have your sample and you want to cool it. So if you put your run a current through it, it will excise heat on one side and or add heat on the other side, depending on whether you want to warm or cool the sample. And the other shows the power generation, how you would convert electric and thermal heat. Now, you should notice that in doing these applications, we always have both a positive terminal, so a P junction, P region. So this is positively doped semiconductor. And on this side, we have an N region, which is a negatively doped semiconductor. And the current will go around the circuit as shown here. So here's the path of the current. So sometimes it's in the direction of the heat flow, like in this direction. Well, this is the cold one, and that's the hot. So heat will flow from here to cool it. Well, that gives you the direction. And so in this one here is a picture of the power conversion. And in both cases, so what will determine the efficiency of this process? Well, one thing that you want is you want to have the electrons or the carriers of the current to flow easily. So you want something with a high electrical conductivity. You obviously want to have a high coefficient for the Seebeck coefficient or Peltier coefficient, either way. You want to have a large value because you want to have a small temperature gradient produce a large voltage so you can measure something. So we like to have then very large thermal power. And we want the denominator, that is the thermal conductivity, to be low. Why is that? If we have a temperature gradient across the sample, then we would like to have that temperature gradient preserved. We don't want that dissipated with time. So we, as a result of that, we like to keep the thermal conductivity very small so we can preserve and not diminish the temperature difference. So the measure of all of these properties is called the figure of merit, thermoelectric figure of merit, which is shown here, and it's a dimensionless number. So it's just a number. And that number turns out, by coincidentally, is approximately 1 for the best thermoelectric materials that have been produced up till about 1990. It just happens to be 1. So, and I'll tell you more about this. So why do we like? So here's our refrigerator, a picture of a refrigerator that Ming put together for us. And why do we like thermoelectrics? Well, there are no moving parts. That makes the system very quiet. There's no emission of bad gases as there are for fluorohydrocarbons. And there's no size dependence. A small one is just as good as a large one. It's easy to integrate with electronics because we can have it sitting on the same pad that your electronics is located, and it could be integrated with the electronics to give you immediate cooling. And so there's applications out there right now for quick cooling and for small device cooling. But why isn't it used widely? The reason that it's not used widely is that the efficiency of thermoelectric systems today is on the order of one. And what we're working with in the research domain is to improve this figure of merit from one to be competitive with today's refrigerators that work with motors and fluorohydrocarbons. So this is where we are today, and this is where we'd like to be. So we have to improve our systems quite dramatically. And there have been two kind of big changes, big improvements that have happened in the last 10 years. So this field was dormant for about 25 to 30 years. There were no people working in the field, essentially. But in recent times, it's become a very active field because of two things. One having to do with nano, and that's what I'm going to be talking about here. And the other one having to do with new materials that are made in bulk quantities that have nano components in them. Because when you look at those materials, the reason why they work is because they contain nano in some kind of large system. And I'll demonstrate that as we move along. So this is to show you a little bit where thermoelectrics are used today. One of the biggest users is NASA. And if you want to have a space mission that goes to Jupiter or beyond, you have no choice but thermoelectrics. We have no technology today that will provide the power that's necessary for space flight. And so the reason is that when we're closer to Earth, we have the sun. And the sun provides a certain amount of radiation that you well know. And if you have a solar converter of that radiation, then it's sufficient to run a mission to, say, Mars or the moon or something like that. But if you want to go beyond that, there just isn't enough energy. The sun is, and the planet or where you're going is too far away, so you have to carry your own energy. And so they have a heat source. It's usually some kind of radioactive little reactor, very tiny reactor, because you don't need a lot of conversion from a radioactive source. But that makes heat. And heat is not electricity to run your circuits and all the things that you need on your spacecraft. So what does the conversion is thermoelectrics. So this has been from the beginning of time. And NASA has been interested in this. All the space missions practically have these conversion units. But there are other. You can see here that your on your hand, your body temperature is above that of the ambient environment because you have 37 centigrade for your body. That's usually higher than the room temperature. So that's sufficient to run a wristwatch. So you can have small devices. And if you want to have some device and not have people know about it, that you're recording them or taking information. So the people that do security, they're very interested in thermoelectrics for that kind of reason. All right, I have some other examples. If you want to go on a picnic and you go to Kmart, you can buy a thermoelectric cooler. It's very convenient for that. Or if you want to cool your electronics or optics, it gets hot because we're getting smaller and smaller. There's more heat that's generated, and that has to be the cooling for that is necessary. And it's in that area that mechanical engineers are moving in quite a large number. This is an applications field that's growing right now for the reasons indicated. All right, so now let's go to materials and what are the properties of materials that could be used to provide this thermoelectric conversion or cooling, either way. And so we need to have the high figure of merit, and that's shown here on the top of the view graph, again, to remind you what we need. And so for S, so S is the Seebeck coefficient, we like to have that high, and it's high for heavily doped semiconductors. And now we want to have conductivity. So the conductivity increases as the carrier density increases. And the thermal conductivity also increases as your carrier concentration increases. So where we are here is that we have competing requirements. To have a high Seebeck coefficient, it's hard to have this one high and have these where they're supposed to be, this one high and that one low. So because of that, we have to make some kind of compromise. And in real materials, the compromise really breaks down to that there's a very small range in which good thermoelectrics can be. And so there was, when you take all of these things, quantities, and you plot them out, you get something like this. And this shows you that we want to be in some range between semiconductor and semi-metal to have the magnitudes of these quantities to be appropriate to have a reasonable coefficient for the figure of merit. Now, there's one more problem. There's a problem about the sign of the Seebeck coefficient. Now, in your course, I'm sure that you had some information that if you have the conductivity, electrical conductivity, or the electronic thermal conductivity, those two quantities are independent of the sign of the carrier. But the Seebeck coefficient is proportional to the sign. So electrons make a negative Seebeck coefficient, and holes, positively charged material, would be a positive S. So if you have a material like a semi-metal that has both electrons and holes, there are many materials in nature that have electrons and holes, and would bring you in this part of your phase diagram as shown. Oh, let's get this thing working. Here we are. This part doesn't work because in this part of the phase diagram we have both electrons and holes. So each of those terms could be large, but they cancel each other. One is negative and the other one's positive, so that the sum of them gives you something very low. And because of that, we have to be on the left side of this diagram where we're in heavily doped semiconductors. Okay, so that limits, in practice, the application of this formula to heavily doped semiconductors, and we're in this regime. It was realized that the semiconductors would be the best materials for thermoelectric applications, about 50 years ago, in the 30s. And that was that whole field was developed in Russia, the former Soviet Union. They were the ones, the pioneers in this field, and they strongly promoted research in this area, and they did some of the early great works. What I show here is different materials, and it shows you, because of the materials' properties themselves, each material has a temperature-dependent a Seebeck coefficient, electrical conductivity, thermal conductivity, etc. So we have to factor that into our discussion. So there are some materials that work well at high temperatures, and hard semiconductors that rigid, they have strong mechanical properties and that sort of thing. They work well in the high temperature range. So you have silicon germanium as an example of that. And lead telluride is an intermediate temperature range. It works best. And then bismuth telluride works well at room temperature. So if you want to go and cool your beer and so on, that's the thermoelectric material that you'll use. Many of the applications in electronics are close to room temperature. They might go 100 degrees above room temperature or a little below. But that's still, on this diagram, the best thermoelectric in that temperature range. But if you want to work with something which is a low temperature material, like, for example, maybe someday electronics will be strongly influenced by the ability to have high TC superconductors. And high TC superconductors will be used for whatever applications. And in that range, that will bring us down to maybe lower temperatures, and the bismuth antimony is the good one to use in that range. So the big message is here, depending on your application and what you want to do, you have to look at a picture like that to find the material that's the right one to you, for you, and it has mostly to do with the fact that the different properties of materials are sufficiently temperature dependent, and we have a quotient of S squared sigma over kappa, so we have to factor all of that, take that all into consideration. All right. So what is the motivation for using nanotech? Nanotech came into the picture through some kind of accident, and I was personally involved with it. And really, it was born at, the whole idea was born at a dinner party between four people. It was myself and my husband. We came. We were invited by this French guy who came from Paris, and the dinner party was in Brussels, and really Louvain-la-Neuve, which is a suburb of Brussels. So he came to meet us there, and our host, who's at the university, the professor at the university, hosted this meeting. And so we were going to discuss if there's anything that can be done. This took place about 1989 or 1990. And what this guy, who is a big shot in the French thermoelectrics industry, and he wanted to know if there was any way that one could change this figure of merit and increase it. And so what we came up with at this dinner was since the 1960s, when the last big advance in the field was made, many things had happened in material science, and in particular that we were talking about superlattices, quantum confined systems, artificially structured systems. So there were all of these ideas out there, and the question was whether any of these ideas could be useful. And a motivation was that as long as you were in a three-dimensional system, if you try to increase the Seebeck coefficient, the electrical conductivity will go down so that this product remains essentially independent of anything that you do with the system. And if you try to increase the electrical conductivity, the thermal conductivity will go up. So it's hard to independently change that quotient. So, but what the idea was is if we could go to a low-dimensional system, then we would have an independent parameter that we could use to tweak, to change each of these quantities independent of one another. So we could use size in some way. That was the idea that we came. We didn't know if it was going to happen, but it was the idea. So you have an independent way, handle. And in fact, that turned out to be a very good idea. And the other important idea is that if you have a small system, you introduce interfaces. And if you can engineer the interfaces in such way that the electrons are not affected very much by the interface, so that they continue to conduct electricity without much notice of the interface, but that the phonons, the carriers of heat, they're strongly interrupted by this interface and strongly reflected. If you could do something like that, But, and of course, in a low-dimensional system, you have many, many interfaces, so you could benefit from that. And if we could do that, perhaps we could beat this game and improve the figure of merit. So, well, it was a discussion topic, and we didn't know if it was right. Nobody around the table knew it was right, and nothing really too much happened. And then maybe 3 years later, here at MIT, I had some people from the U.S. Navy, so this is different. But they were influenced by this guy that invited us from France, because he was a big consultant for the French Navy. And at that time, the French Navy and the U.S. Navy used to talk to each other. Maybe that doesn't happen today, but at that time, that was in effect. So these guys came, and we had a session, and they sort of encouraged me to look in this some more. So I had it in the back of my head, and you know, at MIT, we have all these smart students. So very soon after this visit, a smart student walked into my office. He was looking for a problem. So I said, I have a homework size problem for you. I haven't worked it out, but I think that maybe there could be an effect. But it's a very small thing. We'll know in a week's time whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. So what this guy did, and I'll show you a little bit, because Gong Chen told me to explain to you about two-dimensional systems. So I'll explain to you what we calculated. And this is kind of what I call a back-of-the-envelope calculation. So 1 week after the student, he was a new student, didn't know any, you know, he was just beginning. Student walked in. So we had a paper, sent it into physical review. And it was a really amazing thing, because there's no topic, you know, no category. When you send in a paper to a journal, they ask you what is the category of the paper. Well, there was no category for thermoelectrics or thermoelectric material. There was no way to classify this paper, but we sent it in anyway. And we got a really great review from the referee, who said this was really a new idea and interesting. So he encouraged us very much. So we did two dimensions. If it's good in two dimensions, let's try one dimension. That's smaller, more quantum confinement. And it was better even in one dimension. And then we had the idea that I'm going to explain to you of making a material that is normally a good thermoelectric, but it has the ingredients of being good. That is, it's a semi-metal, so it has the electrons and the holes independently are good for thermoelectricity, but because they occur together, they cancel each other out. So the material is not good, but it could be good if we can make it in small dimensions and make it into a semiconductor. So I'm going to explain that. So we did these three papers in roughly 2 months. So this is quite a good thing for a beginning graduate student. And then we struggled for 2 years or 2.5 years to actually prove this in the lab, because it was really, really difficult at that time to find a system that we can control the electrons independently, make proper barriers so that the electrons didn't go right across the barriers. So it was a hard engineering problem, but we succeeded after a while. And it was amazing how well the theory and the experiment agreed. And it's been the story throughout this whole thing that we've been able to do a really good job in predicting what we can see for the model systems that we made. So the first phase of this work, and I'll tell you a little bit about it, was in terms of developing model systems so we understand the systems that might be good to make thermoelectricity. We're now in a new phase starting the last couple of years, and some of the students in this room are working on this new phase and trying to make something that's more of interesting from a manufacturing point of view, where you can make larger quantities more cheaply, because the individual initial work was made with super lattices that required molecular beam epitaxy and real fancy techniques. So that's the big picture what I'm going to talk about. And I told you a little bit about the human history. You know, when we teach courses around here, it's always like we knew everything already, and you just read it in the book. But actually, the discovery process is often very interesting and leads some insight for students on what they should be looking for when they do their own research, because almost everybody doing research has some opportunity to discover something very important. And it's easy to overlook that. And many people miss many things. So always keep your mind open to new things. So what the low-dimensional systems do is they give us a way to enhance the density of states. I'm going to talk about that. And by doing that, we're able to increase the Seebeck coefficient. So we have a handle of what we can do. And we can do that somewhat independently of sigma. That's kind of the idea. And with the interfaces, we can design the interfaces. And I can explain some of these strategies that we develop for that so that the electrons are not so strongly scattered as the phonons. And then, of course, we have to make real systems. And that's not easy. One of the reasons it's not easy is that most of semiconductor know-how is related to the semiconductor electronics industry. And those materials are not really so useful near room temperature. Silicon is not, as you notice, has a very low figure of merit around room temperature. So it itself cannot be used for electronics applications. And the materials that are good thermoelectric materials, very little is known about them. So that is, the material science is not known. So when you work in a field like that, you have to sort of invent the technology that has been developed in something like silicon for the last 30, 40 years. At the time, it's more than that, because at the time, 1940s is when the technology of silicon and germanium, for that matter, germanium was developed first. Because they thought the first transistor was made of germanium, not silicon, because it has a higher mobility, so people thought that would be good material. Okay, onward. So here's a historical perspective. I sort of already preempted this. I told you that in the early days, before 1960, back in former Soviet Union, it went from very low value to reach these values that were sort of close to one. And so that was in the late 50s, mid-50s. And then hardly anything happened until the 1990s. And then things started to take off. And so there were two things. One is the nano, and the other was the macro materials. They have nano constituents. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you a little bit about the density of states. Now, you've had this in your course, but maybe it hasn't been described this way. But the density of states is what I show on this top line, and that's the number of states that you have, quantum mechanical states, that you have per unit energy range. If you have a three-dimensional, if you have a bulk solid like this, so this is a bulk piece of something, silicon, there's a continuum of states, and it's a smooth curve, and it looks like what's shown there called 3D. Once you have quantum confinement, that is, you have one dimension that's very thin, that has maybe 100 atoms. So then in that dimension, you don't have any longer a continuum of states, but you have these states, they're quantized, and we count them individually. And for those situations, the density of states becomes the staircase. And I have some view graph that will help you to how to calculate. You might have had that for a homework problem, so you know that already. And but this still looks a little bit like it's like the 3D, but with some steps. But when you get to a quantum wire, you see something that's really dramatically different. That looks like a molecule. You have these singularities in the density of states. The singularities are like atomic energy levels and molecular energy levels. And then finally, when you're in the quantum dot, then you have small distances in all three dimensions, x, y, z, and the states really look like a molecule. So in going from the bulks, the bulk might be somewhere here in a calculation, a simple back-of-the-envelope calculation like we did in that 1 week. So what we did in that 1 week project is we took the formula that you know from your solid state course. Maybe you don't have, some of you have taken a solid state course, and that allows you to calculate density of states, electrical conductivity, and so forth, just for a simple free carrier model. That's all we did in the first paper. And showed that dimensionality, because of these steps, makes a big difference in the calculation of the thermoelectric figure of merit. So we got something that looked like this for 2D, and 3D, 1D went shooting up. And we didn't calculate 0D because it took us almost 10 years to figure out how to do a 0D case. Because at 0D, you have this dot. And how do you connect to the dot? Because the dot is material. But now we figured out how to do it, that you just put a whole bunch of dots together, and then you can do it. So what the situation is, and I explained this already, is that we want to have a material that has the following conceptual requirements. And the details is not important because only a small fraction of you might do anything with thermoelectricity in your careers. But the concept is important. Like I was walking over with Ming here. You know, we do in our group a lot of work on carbon nanotubes. And thermoelectricity and carbon nanotubes doesn't have much to do with each other. But I just thought of a new experiment that's pretty exciting, and this is doping carbon nanotubes. And when you have a very small system, how do you figure out how many charges you have in the sample? So that's not so easy, but thermopower is a good way to do this. So you never know when some piece of knowledge is useful in your career. So just get a few of the essentials of this lecture. That's sufficient. And then maybe in your career you may have to come back with it. So what the idea of a thermoelectric is to have a material where the electrons can go through very easily because the electrons are the carriers of the electrical current. That's the conduit of the electric current. But we want the phonons to be, they carry the heat. Phonons carry the heat, but we don't want the heat to be carried. We want the two ends of our material to maintain their temperature difference. So we want the heat to be lousy conductor, and we want the electrons to be good conductor. And so we would like to have the mean free path for the phonons to be small compared to the dimensions of the sample. So you have this situation that's shown here. But we want the electrons to move forth without any problem. That's kind of conceptually what you want. And I'm going to show you some examples of materials. They have many interfaces. So this happens many times. And so we have to have interfaces are really important. All right. Now, Gung Chen told me that I'm supposed to say something about low-dimensional systems. So let me see where I am here in my class so I finish on time. And three dimensions. So no quantization. The electron moves from one state to another. The states are, there's so many states that we can consider the states as a continuum. So, and this shows you momentum, crystal momentum, h bar squared k squared over 2m star. That's what this is, and three dimensions. So it just goes straight, and the energy momentum relation is shown here. So it's just parabolic. This is parabolic dependence. That's what that's supposed to be. Ming drew it by hand, more or less. And if you have a semiconductor, this is supposed to show you a semiconductor. So we have a state in the valence band, highest state in the valence band, and then a conduction band. And the difference here is the band gap. And normally for thermoelectric materials, the band gap is sort of smallish. Most of them have band gaps of tenths of an EV. So they're sort of in the infrared regime, the good ones that we know about. All right, now here's a quantum well. So a quantum well means that we have a material and we interrupt it by having a small region D. D has a small number of atoms, maybe 100 atoms, something like that, so that we have to consider the discreteness of the energies. So the discreteness of the energy is shown by this relation here, which says that we fit in the wave. So we have this, imagine that this is the thin layer, and so we match the boundary condition so that the wave function on this side and the wave function on this side are exactly in phase. So that gives you a relation for your wave vector that it has to be an integral number of wavelengths, you know, contained in the size of the material, and that's how you get that relation. So that's sort of the main idea of quantization. There was a question.
I'm just curious, we talk about quantum wells, what's the dimension, typical dimension of D, and how do we achieve it in engineering?
Okay. For the quantum wells that for our very first experimental demonstration that the students struggled mightily for a long time, the size of the quantum wells, the thickness, D, was 20 angstrom, 2 nanometers. And at that point, we got large quantum effects for thermoelectricity. But it took a pretty small thickness. Now, actually, we tried in the beginning to do bismuth, but we couldn't do the material science because there wasn't enough known about the material science. We had done it on bismuth, we could have had a larger size because bismuth has such a small effective mass. You see, the mass goes in the denominator, so you get a big amplification of this distance. So because of that, we could, if we had solved the material science problem, we could have worked with bigger samples. But that came later. I can tell you there's a human interest story that came where I got the idea. I was talking to a guy who was working on oil wells, and he had discovered a new material that they made little gadgets for the for oil wells. It had nothing to do with thermoelectricity, of course, but he made some kind of porous structure that was well organized. I'll show it to you later. And I saw that. I said, now I know how to make quantum wires that will be thermoelectric. Okay, so now with the quantum wells, we have quantization in one direction. We'll call that the z direction. So we have these. And so we have n equals 1, 2, 3, 4. Those are the quantum states. And so we have a subband. N equals 1 is the first subband. Let's get this pointer going here. Okay, so n equals 1 is the first subband, and then n equals 2 is the second subband, the third subband, etc. But associated with each of these subbands, we have still a continuum in the x and y directions. So we call these subbands, and they're separated by some energy. So here's the energy between the subbands. And that's shown over here. So we have the green material with the wide gap, and then the blue material with the small gap. And in this region here, we have quantum confinement, and we have quantum confined states denoted by 1, 2, 3, 4 in this kind of quantum well. So this is a quantum box, and inside this quantum box, we can stick electrons, and they go into these special states. So the size, the biggest one would be bismuth, and that would be 50 nanometers, something like that. You can begin to see. I'll show you. As I go along, you'll see some quantum effects. They're not so big, but they're certainly measurable because we measure them. And here's the one-dimensional system. So in the one-dimensional system, you have quantum confinement in two directions now, y and z, as you can see over there. Same thing. We fit in an integral number of wavelengths in the region of our quantum confined region so that the wave function on this side and that side match up. They're the same thing. And that gives us then these kind of states with a continuum that's along the quantum wire. Okay, so the continuum is along this direction, the x direction in this case, and we have these continuous states are in the x direction. And then we can do, here's the quantum dot, of course, so we have confinement in x, y, z, so this is like a molecule. And so how do you get any conductivity? Well, you have to enclose this in something else to which the electrons can easily flow from that something else into the quantum dot and then flow out again. So when you can do that, and we figured out how to do this, you have to have something that's isoelectronic. That means it's in the same column of the periodic table so that the phonons think it's a totally different material, but the electrons think it's almost the same material. So that's the way we fool them and solve this problem. But it took us a while to figure it out. So here we're back to the same picture, and I give you a review of 3D, 2D, 1D, and 0D. So once you have the energy levels, then you can find out how many levels there are per unit energy distance between one state and another. And having that then we can calculate all the physical quantities like thermal conductivity, electrical conductivity, et cetera. And again, to remind you, this condition of what we need for a good thermoelectric, which is shown here, very good scattering from the phonons and poor scattering from the electrons. All right, now we'll go. So this shows cooling effects in a superlattice. Now this is demonstrated paper 2001. And so they in that paper they get quite large ZTs. They have figure of merits over 2. And it's done by doing temperature difference is across this interface, so it's in the transverse direction. And you can see there are two isoelectronic materials. There's bismuth telluride and antimony telluride. So electrically, these materials are very similar, but thermally, they're different. They have a different mass, so you get scattering, and that's how they manage to get a good mismatch. Another thing, here's the quantum dot superlattice of Ted Harmon at Lincoln Lab here close by. And what he did is he put layers of lead telluride with a little bit of selenium. He would interrupt the growth and inject, just for a very short time, a pulse of selenium. And that produced these quantum dot islands. And so you could see some schematic of these islands. And these islands provided, since these materials are isoelectronic, you could get good scattering of the phonons, poor scattering of the electrons. So with this material, first in 2001, or 2000, that's the picture on the drawing, he got a ZT of 2 at not 300 degrees. Then later, I think it's 2002, at room temperature, he managed to get a ZT of 2. And now he reported this very last MRS, a ZT of 3. And so 3 gets very interesting for people. But that was at elevated temperatures. I think it was 500 or 600 degrees, where lead telluride has a maximum in bulk. All right. So now I used most of my time for telling you a little about the background. And now I'm going to go through this next part quickly. So just the flavor is sufficient. So I'm going to tell you about 1D systems. So this shows you how we make the 1D systems, and this is what I learned from this guy that worked in the oil industry. And they were using these kind of templates for separations for enhancing oil recovery. Okay, and that has nothing to do with thermoelectricity, but I saw that structure and I said, gee, if we could figure out a way to put something like bismuth in there, maybe we can make a quantum wire. And we tried it, and it worked within, the first time we tried it, it worked, because somebody in chemical engineering knew how to do this ceramic technology. So MIT is a good place with a lot of experts, otherwise it would have been difficult, because at that time there were no physics people that were doing this kind of work. This was chemical engineering in the oil industry. All right, so, and the top view of one that we made, and this one, it goes back quite a few years. You could see triangular lattice. So it self-assembles, and you make these holes. Smallest holes we had is 7 nanometers. And biggest holes that we made was about 300 nanometers. But I guess you could have even bigger ranges, but that's what we did. And then we fill these things with bismuth. For example, some low-temperature material, we also fill them with antimony, which isn't that low temperature. We have different techniques of filling them. We have pressure injection, vapor phase, and electrochemistry. And we've developed those techniques over the years. So, and then we can dissolve the template after we make the wires, and then we have freestanding wires that you see over there. So that's sort of the big picture. Free wires are for doing detailed scientific studies. Obviously, you're not going to use that for thermoelectric. You don't have enough material to cool anything or make any power conversions. You need large quantities to make that. So the template is very good for large quantities. You get 10 to the 11th wires, nanowires per square centimeter. That's, you know, huge number of them. So we're talking really about a bulk sample when you make the whole thing together. All right, now I'm going to tell you a little bit. This is added. This is Gong Chen's request that we explain to you the difference between semiconductors and semi-metals, because some of the ideas that we've had in dealing with thermoelectrics have come from our knowledge of semi-metals, but semi-metals are not good thermoelectrics because they have electrons and holes. So let me explain. So a direct gap semiconductor, gallium arsenide is an example of that. 3-5 compounds are good examples of those. And the top of the valence band and the bottom of the conduction bands are at the same place in reciprocal space. So you get a direct band gap. Optoelectronics likes this kind of system. Silicon and germanium is of this sort, indirect gap semiconductor, where the holes are at K equals zero, zone center. And the electrons are some other place, the different places for silicon and germanium. Doesn't matter for this class exactly where they are for discussion, but they're different places. So now imagine the following. Now I'm going to make a semi-metal out of them. A semi-metal means that, I consider this case on the right, the bismuth is like this. So that the holes are at one place, and this is the holes, unoccupied states in the valence band. So we have hole states. And this is related to this by bringing the whole band up above the Fermi level. The Fermi level tells you that all the states below that place, that energy, are occupied, and all the states above that energy are empty at zero temperature. So So what we do here is we have brought this band up in energy, so we have whole states here, and we brought this state down. Nature, of course, does that to make bismuth. Bring it down here, and then we have electron state. So we have overlap, so we have electrons here, holes here. And because of the nature of physics, these things occur, both semiconductors and in semi-metals. Semiconductor, like silicon, is a semiconductor which, if it's intrinsic, has no carriers whatsoever, because it fills a number of bands completely, has just enough electrons. There is a column 4 of the periodic table. So you have enough electrons to fill 2 Brillouin zones with spin-up and spin-down electrons. That's why the valence 4, because we have 2 atoms per unit cell. Maybe I went too quick. Too much information for you. But that's the way a semiconductor works. We completely fill these bands. With a semi-metal, we sort of fill these bands, but because of the shape of the, in reciprocal space, of the unit cell, some of the energy states spill over, and we get a couple of very small number of electrons that are in the next higher level. So they're shown over here. And the holes that are left behind or someplace else in the zone. So here they are. So these are the occupied ones, and these are the ones that are left behind. And the volumes in K-space for those two are the same, because it's like silicon. You have just enough electrons in the material to totally fill bands. So a semi-metal is sort of like a semiconductor, but because of other circumstances, it doesn't make it. The states, the bands aren't totally filled, but they're in this situation. So if you have a metal like zinc, which is column 2 of the periodic table, you're sort of in a similar situation, but there you have a free electron model. I always give that as an example in my solid-state physics course. So you could see that in something like zinc, the number of carriers is quite small. And the reason is you get a cancellation with this kind of a filling of this kind of band and that kind of band. And so in the end, you don't have very many left. Okay, and I mentioned on the bottom that you can make a situation where, in this case, where the valence and conduction bands also touch, and that gives you a zero-gap semiconductor. Zero-gap semiconductors used to be a curiosity in physics, but recently they became very important with nanotubes, because nanotubes are based on zero-gap semiconductors, and you know that they become and maybe 1,000 people all over the world, maybe 10,000 people working on nanotubes now, so it's becoming interesting. Okay, that's your briefing on on semi-metals and semiconductors. And semi-metals, I'm going to explain in a view graph now, can be made into semiconductors. Semi-metals, we start out with this situation here, and they can be made into semiconductors by reducing the size. So if you go to a smaller system, then so instead of having something that's a millimeter, you have something that's a nanometer in size. So then we have quantum confinement. And then the lowest level in the conduction band rises, as you can see here, and the highest level in the valence band falls, and eventually they cross. In bismuth, they cross at 50 nanometers, which is quite a big size. In the laboratory, we can make those kinds of samples and observe the semi-metal semiconductor transition, and we've done experiments like that that proves that it really happens. And not only that, but it happens where we expect it to happen. And it depends, of course, on the crystalline orientation. So that's about bismuth. Now, what I hope you can see well enough to see when we make these quantum wires how beautiful the lattice planes organize. This is, you could see, it's a wonderful crystal pattern. So bismuth makes single crystals that are very well oriented with very large mean free paths, and that's why it works well for a thermoelectric application. So here's the, okay, let me explain about this a little bit. I'm going fast, but I still say something here. So over here's the X-ray diffraction pattern, which is taken on these 10 to the 11th per square centimeter wires. Okay, we have many, many wires, and you get some spots. And from the spots, we know what the direction of the axis is, because it's the crystalline direction. Now we can do electron diffraction on just 1 nanometer, because bismuth is a very heavy metal, so it scatters electrons very well. We can get the diffraction pattern of just 1 nanowire. And the interesting thing, of course, is that the diffraction pattern that you get from 1 nanowire and from a whole mess of them, large quantity, is the same. So then we know something about the homogeneity of the crystalline orientation. And that's very important in doing a nanoelectronics, because you want to make a system, you want them all to be similar. Otherwise, you have no quality control of your device. So, okay. Another way that we can do the same thing is by alloying. So if by adding a small amount of antimony to bismuth, we can also produce a phase transition from the semi-metal to a semiconductor. So we have two different control mechanisms, which I show you here. So this is what happens in the bulk, 3D band structure, and it shows you that when we add a small amount of antimony, just a few atomic percent, the conduction band moves down, valence band moves up, and they cross. So we have a region here where we have a semiconductor, and then for larger concentrations of antimony, the band gap closes again. So between here and here, we can have a semiconductor. And we utilize that when we do nanostructures. So we have two tools. We have diameter and concentration. And in that way, we can make systems that are to our liking. So we look around in nanoscience, we always look around with controls, how we can control the system. So this is okay, so now this is a calculation. This is done by some other students a little bit later. You can see 2001. And we calculated the same thing in, for a nanowire. And Ming is trying now to calculate the same thing for 2D structure. So we have thin film and see what the phase diagram is when you add a small amount of antimony. We'll get something like that, but it's going to be different. You see that these phase diagrams are really very strongly dependent on dimensionality. This one is nowhere like this one. They're just the regions are quite different. I can go into this in detail, but there's no time. Just to say that these two factors, and maybe in other systems that you guys are interested in, your own research, there may be some other handle. These are not necessarily the only handles that you can change properties of nanostructures. And that's why nanostructures are so interesting. We couldn't make them until recently, so this is a whole new field of science that we're exploring in, you know, as you're becoming of age. So that's why this is interesting for you people. So now this is to show you measurements on the Seebeck coefficient. So this is the what creates thermoelectricity. So we could start with some temperature-dependent effect, and I say that as the temperature increases, the magnitude of the Seebeck coefficient becomes larger, so that's good for thermoelectricity. So that's why going to high temperatures tends to be a plus. And now I'm going to make the just moving down in the phase diagram, going to smaller sizes, you can see with the red arrow there. And you could see that the Seebeck coefficient increases. Okay, that's what I've been telling you all the time. You go to smaller size, more quantum confinement, and you get improvement in thermoelectricity. Now I'm going to use some antimony alloying. I said adding some antimony creates a semiconductor. That's good. So you could see that the black dot has to do with the addition of some antimony, and then the blue is a combination of the two. And you could see all of these factors improve the Seebeck coefficient. Okay, so that's what we were hoping for, and that's what we see experimentally. All right, and this is a little bit more about nanowires, and this is a little more technical. It says nothing is forever. When you get down to very small sizes, then you get localization. The electrons get stuck on impurities. They get stuck on different things, and they do not conduct. So there's a limit to how small we can make these nanowires. And you have to make some kind of measurement. We don't have yet a predictability at which size this happens. So when you're working on something that has to do with depending on quantum of confinement effects, you always have to check where localization takes place. And there's some kind of confinement region. There's something that inhibits the motion of the carriers, whether they're electrical or thermal. So you have to always worry about this. Okay. All right, that's what that's about. Okay, now I have something about quantum dot superlattices. And I'll move through that quickly. So if 2D is better than 3D and 1D is better than 2D, what about 0D? So this was something that was puzzling us for a while, but we couldn't figure out how to do it. So here are the quantum dots, and we couldn't figure out a way to assemble them because the quantum dots, here they are, they're all separated from each other. How do you get electricity to go from one to another? Because thermal power has to do with thermoelectric effects has to do with transport, so we have to connect them in some way. So how do we do this? Well, obviously, we have to combine the 2D and the 1D, so we get a superlattice nanowire. As you can see, we take the two materials and we make a sandwich of them, like in a superlattice, and then we get 0D. So we have confinement in all three directions. And now, without any mathematics or any more pictures, you could imagine that we arrange the system because the fundamental idea of thermoelectricity to make a device is to have the electrons flow easily and the phonons to have difficulty, to be heavily scattered. So what are we going to do with the interface? So we're going to select these two materials, the green and the white materials, so that the electrons flow easily. So we make them isoelectronic. We make the materials so they're similar to another, so that the electrons see almost the same band structure. But the phonons will have very different masses, so they get scattered at the interface. So that's what the idea is. And we tried some different systems to see what was good. And we were lucky because this problem turned out that there were good examples in the literature. With the discovery of giant magnetoresistance, people made superlattice out of magnetic material. So this is magnetic cobalt, this is magnetic and copper isn't. And this was used for very early experiments on spin valve technology, which, you know, in your computers, you have magnetic storage of memory. It's based on the spin valve. And so that's like these materials with superlattice. That's what the idea, that's what's in your computers, something like that. The size is about 15 nanometers. This is the magnetic little film that stores all the information. You have lots of these because you have megabytes of information, so you have many, many of these units. Okay. Recently, so 2002, and this was somewhat motivated by this thermoelectrics work because we had been saying, gee, you know, it would be nice to figure out a way to make a superlattice of quantum dots. So There it is, with silicon and germanium, and made by vapor liquid solid phase, which is a standard way, has become in the last 2 years a standard way to grow nanowires. And here's the most beautiful nanowire, the one I really like, on the right, made in Sweden, where you could see the interface of the indium phosphide, which is the red, is about 2 to 3 atomic thicknesses. So this is, somebody was asking me how small these things are. You could see how small they make them. And that's a beautiful interface. I hope it's apparent to you. You can see it. So the technology is there. And these different sizes were made for demonstration to show you what the control they have making these interfaces. And with these two, so these are semiconductors. And if you had an electron that's in the lattice, it would go right through without much scattering. That's the idea. So we have, here's Yu Ming Lin, and some of you might know him. He graduated a year ago. He's now at IBM working on nanotubes, carbon nanotubes, but still nano something. And he actually, since getting there, he sort of turned up over the field. He really made a big discovery that makes the electronics of nanotubes a lot more feasible. He figured out how to engineer the structure so that you can get high mobilities. And he made very substantial progress for them. Anyway, so here are the parameters. So we arrange the parameters we have a whole bunch of assumptions, but they're set up so that the electrons go easily and that the phonons are scattered. That's the main thing that you have to know from this. No more details necessary. And because you have the two materials, they're different, you're going to have some band offsets, and you want the band offsets to be small enough so that the electrons flow easily, but it can't be zero because you want to have some kind of scattering mechanism for the phonons too. And so we have two limits. The one limit on your left, the alloy limit, is where the interface is so fuzzy that you can't tell that you have a superlattice. And the other case is where the separation is so large, and you say, how big do you have to make them? You make them too big, you have no effect. You have too many quantum states, and you can't see anything. So the best place to operate is where you have innumerable 10 quantum states, something like that, as shown here. And then you can, that's a good place where quantum mechanics comes in, and you can get interesting effects. So the system that we found that worked best over a wide temperature range was the lead salt system. So the paper we published is about that. But we really tried a bunch of other things first, but they weren't as successful. So this one turns out to work nicely for nanowire superlattices. And the lead salts, a lot is known about them, both from the material science standpoint and also from the point of view of thermoelectricity. So we were lucky. When we did our first demonstration of the 2D system, we also did the lead salts because we could do that in the time length of a thesis. All the other things that maybe seem more promising, there was just too many other intermediate steps that had to be solved. That it's like the high energy physics thesis. It takes 15 years before you get a result, and people in our fields are not interested in that. So we worked in the lead salts. And there are many results in this paper. It shows the variation of everything. So you vary the outer diameter, you vary the segment length, you vary the materials, you can make them equal in length, not equal in length. There are all of these different things that we try. But it's not important for your discussion now. The main overriding thing that's found always is the more quantum confinement, you get this big increase in the ZT. And this was for a nanowire of size 10 nanometers. For lead salts, we have to have them a little bit less than 10, maybe 7 is a good number. And then we can beat the refrigerator in your kitchen. So that's kind of the ballpark where we have to be. And it's shown in that paper. So then we have to try to engineer something in the laboratory that's of that general length scale. It gives you the ballpark number where you're heading. And now I have 10 minutes or so. Maybe it's enough to tell you about. I have just a couple of view graphs for each of them, where the field is going now. So chemistry. I don't know how many chemistry people are here. But the way that you want to make, probably will make nanowires in very large numbers might be a electrochemical technique, because with that it's cheap and you can make large quantities in a manufacturing mode. Bismuth is a very hard material to work with if you want to do something with bismuth, and maybe also lead salts, because you wear away the template. It corrodes. It dissolves on you. So we have to be in a pH close to 7. So you have to find the right electrolyte. So student, Oded, some of you know Oded Rabin, he figured out how to do this. MIT students are smart. They always solve these problems. But it takes time, because nobody had done anything like that. Nobody had an electrolyte. The second thing that he figured out is that when people were using electrochemistry, and there was kind of some literature on this, they got these real minuscule crystallites. So you have so much scattering and random orientations that it wouldn't be good for thermoelectricity. You wouldn't have electron transport, too much scattering from the electrons. So he figured out a way to crystallize them so that the crystallite size would be increased. And then he figured out a way how to grow these things compatible with silicon technology. And that allowed him to make much larger templates, and to make templates where you can have a region where you can infiltrate N-type material, and another region where you can infiltrate P-type material by having different electrodes attached to the two sides. Okay, these are kind of details, but if you're an engineering person and you have to make a device, you have to think about all of these things. So I'm just giving you an idea that you can do many things. And here are some of the nanowires that he made on these templated substrates. Maybe it doesn't show up so well. But people at JPL, he went over and showed them how he did it, and they made these wires. And NASA liked them, so that's what we know. And here's a mess of nanowires that were made by the electrochemical route, so you can make large quantities and infiltrate them in your substrate for cooling purposes or whatever you want. And this is a project that several people in the group are working, because I'm involved with them. And this is, Gang Chen had this idea about how to self-organize nanostructures so that you can produce large numbers of them over large volumes. And so, as you see, we have nanoparticles or nanowires, and they're not organized in lattice, but there's some randomness to them. And the idea is, and we have to demonstrate this still, is that you don't lose very much in ZT by having a random structure. As long as you have some organization to it, it doesn't have to be well organized. So we have to find out on what, under what conditions and what limitations there are for making self-assembly to get reasonable ZT. And here is an example of a 3D material. When we look at any of the 3D materials that have been successful, we can find some little structures within them that are small and that are in the order of 2 nanometers or so, that are themselves good thermoelectrics, but they're buried in something else. So this picture is what nature does, or chemistry does, whereas the picture before is what physics does in the lab. So you take particles, you mix them together, and you put them in a substrate. So that's that one. And this one is you add a dopant, and the chemistry will make these little structures inside. You don't make the structures, but chemistry makes them inside the material. So we call that a 3D crystal, but it really contains these little units that are nano in type. And new tools. So one of the professors in EE was a co-author on this paper, but the origin of this idea comes from somebody that does nanothermal mechanical engineering department at UC Berkeley. And his name is Majumdar. You've probably heard about him in this course in other ways because he does a lot of interesting things. And he's been a person that's been developing the scanning thermal probes. So very tiny, and this is one of his students and another student that moved to University of Texas at Austin. And they made a scanning tip that's sensitive to thermoelectricity. So, you know, like you have the AFM, so that's sensitive to force. The STM is sensitive to conductivity. This one's sensitive to thermal power. And so you can measure the thermal power as you go spatially, and the resolution is just a couple of nanometers. And this is going to be a very important tool for nano things. So I'm on my last view graph, and it's 2:19, so it's pretty good in time. So I've covered today some of the model systems. I've given you some examples. I said a little bit about what thermoelectricity is about and given you some examples in lower dimensions, 2D, 1D, 0D. 0D, we're at a very beginning stage. We don't have very much yet in the literature. 1D is more developed, but it's a pretty new field. It's maybe 6 years old, so things are still moving pretty fast. 2D is now almost 10 years old, so we know a lot more about it. And now we're in the basic science of it is somewhat established enough that we're in a time now to start moving into applications, because the people that fund this kind of research, they want to see results. If you have a company, the company wants to start producing something to see what are the limitations, what are the opportunities, what are some of the applications areas that we haven't thought about because we're still in the laboratory proving the principles. So this is a good time for engineers to get into it. So Gong Chen likes to have it in his course, so that's why he invited me to talk a bit. And then I said something where we're working today, and today it's moving out in a lot of directions. 10 years ago, at a conference, there would be five people, and there would be one session at a conference, and a very, very small number of people that knew what the others were talking about. You know, it was a very limited audience. Now there are a few hundred people working in this worldwide. So it's really changed a lot. And there are some companies. The early companies are more focused on using these low-dimensional thermoelectrics for semiconductor electronics thermal management. Because, as you know, the semiconductor industry is getting smaller and smaller size devices. And the power generation goes up per unit area. So that cooling becomes one of the limiting factors to performance in semiconductor electronics, optoelectronics as well. And so some cooling kind of devices are needed. And this is becoming a topic now in mechanical engineering departments many, many places. And so some of the ideas are here already, but to make something that's commercial and that you have a company that produces something, large quantities, that's still for people like you in the room, because that's not here yet. So that's kind of for futures. And do I think that something will happen? Yeah, there's something that will happen, because there are some companies out there that are actually making money with thermoelectrics. And some of it is little things. Some of the, maybe not the cheapest models, automobiles, but the next level up, they have seats that, especially if you want to be in a warm climate, and you can have thermoelectrically cooled seats. So when it's hot outside, You not only have the air, but your body is nicely taken care of. And the company is making a lot of money. So, and they're one of the nice contributors to small-scale research. They come to our meetings. It's all driven by science-type people that are running the company. And so that's not something we exactly imagined. You know, it's a long way from having thermoelectrics for spacecraft. But I bet you that we'll learn a lot of things from these practical companies that are producing large quantities and trying to make it cheap that will be useful for more scientific applications later on. So, anybody have any more questions, technical or philosophical, or big picture, small picture? Yes.
When you talk about engineering, all of these nanowires are embedded in a matrix. The biggest question, I'm a mechanical engineer, so the biggest question I see is, how do you handle these things?
Oh, they're self-assembled. You don't have to handle very much. So, for example, the idea, there's some people that are actually making them in this room. So you can ask them what they're doing. So if you make it chemically, you just have an impurity, and you then heat up the material to a certain temperature, pressure. You know, you look at the phase diagram, and these little crystallites are formed. Or if you have an interface, imagine that you're doing, like you're depositing something like this, you know, with layers. And then you inject an impurity every once in a while. In a periodic, you have some kind of machine that goes blip, blip, blip in a periodic way. And that injection will create little islands of material, because physics tells you that the atoms of the injected thing, they want to stick together. But they also want to make a layer and spread out. So there's a competition between these two because of your temperature gradient. They want to do flat, but the clustering makes them also stick together. So they make these little islands. So that generates quantum dots, and that's been demonstrated now. Oh, in the last 5 years, there's many examples of that now. So that would be a self-assembly way to do it. And another thing that Gong Chen has been working on, so you start with a powder of these nanoparticles, and you mix them in a substrate. So suppose the substrate is in a fluid state, and the particles are in a solid state. You have silicon that has a higher melting temperature than germanium. This is an example. So the germanium will be molten, and then you have some mixing agent. It will mix up the whole mess, and then you get little tiny particles embedded in a host material. And then, of course, you have to control it in a way, because you want to have the separation between adjacent particles to be certain thing. They have to be pretty close to each other to get good quantum confinement phenomena. But you don't want them too touching. So there are restrictions of how you do this. And that's what they're working on now, how to actually self-assemble all of these things and optimize the properties. Well, the early work shows very promising results, that you can make thermal conductivities that are lower than any one of the individual constituents. So that's a promising thing, comes from the theory. But how to optimize the whole thing, we don't know how to do that yet. It's not a total answer to your question, but research is exactly that, because if we knew how to do it, we would have done it. So we're figuring out how to do it. Yeah. Another question? Okay. You have one more class, right? And then you're off for Thanksgiving? Is that?
There's still class on Wednesday.
Oh, so they're giving you early Thanksgiving. Oh, how nice. Okay. So have a nice turkey. After you come back, it's a lot of exams and everything else, right?